start with some examples of the computer being too slow. First of all, the browser, Chrome is supposed to be a very fast browser. Chromium's the open source version. It's supposed to be all the same speed, maybe it's like a different user interface, maybe not the same in terms of flash report and such, but basically the same browser. And I tried loading some web page, bench.cr.yp.to/results-hash.html. And I wasn't surprised that this web page took a long time to load. I don't have the world's fastest internet connection at home, and it's a pretty big page, 8 megabytes, and then there's a bunch of thumbnails, each of which is pretty big, which you can click on to get a lot more data, but it's quite a few pictures included in the page, total of 40 megabytes being loaded. I wasn't watching the page while it was loading, I was doing something else. But then I came back to the page, and I was expecting that when I searched for some text on the page, that would be fast. It's only 8 megabytes of data, and somehow, asking the browser to search for a certain string, Boris, on the page, that took seconds, something like 2.5 seconds. Now, maybe I had my computer in power save mode, maybe it would have been only 1 second if I turned up the clock speed, but that's a long time. Searching through 8 megabytes of data, I must have been looking at every single byte, like, is that Boris, is that Boris, is that Boris, and going through the entire HTML. Finally, it found Boris. Finally, it showed, here's where it is inside this page. Now, why is it taking so long? Well, maybe it just hasn't actually finished loading. Maybe it's has to go through the page the first time to index everything. So I tried doing the search again. I tried searching for another string on the page, and it took the same 2.5 seconds. Tried searching for another string. It clearly wasn't something where it was a one-time cost just for loading the page. This was really slow on every search on this page. You can try it yourself and see how slow this is, or any other big web page. Why is it taking so long? Well, that's what I'll try to address in this talk. Another example of something being really slow, the du command. This is the disk usage command of Unix. If you say du minus x and then give a directory name, leave it out as the current directory, then what this will show you is the total space that's used by all the files within this directory and all the subdirectories. So it'll look through X, inside X it'll look at all the files and then all the directories, it'll look at all the files in those directories and so on. For those of you who say, wait a minute, that could be going on forever because it could have a symbolic link somewhere up in the tree. Well, this doesn't follow symbolic links up, it's just looking at hard links inside the directories. Now I tried this on my home directory, and it's not a slow disk, it's a solid state disk, not a slow laptop. Any guesses for how long this took to run? I could give you a hint that the answer was something like 100 gigabytes inside my home directory.
Seconds?
A minute.
About 2 minutes, 42 seconds. Now, I expect usually my computer is going to give me answers promptly. I press return and I expect before I can blink that I see the answer, especially if it's a very small answer. Okay, if I'm pressing return and showing the whole movie, then I expect it to take an hour or two, but if it's something where it's giving me an answer that's like a few digits, it should be instant, and this is not exactly instant. And again, I tried running it again, figuring, okay, maybe there's something that's slowing it down the first time, but I run exactly the same thing again, and it takes, well, not quite 2 minutes, 42 seconds, but it took 2 minutes. Another example, the make program. This again is something that ends up being surprisingly slow. For those of you, let me actually see, how many people have used make? Okay, I see most people, yes, but I've been assuming in preparing my slides here that there will be some people who want introductions to what I'm talking about, so let me just briefly say the make program has input a make file, which has a long list of commands like this. Say, if you want to build a program called prog, then you run gcc minus o prog prog.c. And you also tell the make program that prog depends on prog.c, so that it knows that if prog.c hasn't changed, if prog is newer than prog.c, it doesn't have to recompile. And that's important if you have thousands, tens of thousands of programs, that it doesn't have to run the compiler again and again, except on the .c's that have actually changed. Now, I tried on a computer with some graphics cards, I tried compiling the NVIDIA GPU software development kit, and that was taking some time, but then afterwards I went back to it and I tried changing a few files inside the software development kit, and ran make. Now, I was expecting it would take a second or two to run the compiler, not a big fry. What I wasn't expecting was that make, just for looking through all the files that it would have to maybe recompile and deciding what it would have to do, make took 15 seconds by itself. And after compiling this, after I ran make, I just tried again, running make yet another time just to verify again this was a repeatable effect. And well, at that point it had compiled everything, there were no changes, but just for looking through it was again 15 seconds, zero compiling. Okay, so these are some examples of the computer running slowly, not giving me the kind of instant response that I want. And in all of these cases, it's easy to imagine how the computer could keep track of more information so that it doesn't have to spend so much time. It can index the file that you're looking through, index the HTML page. I mean, Google does instantaneous searches on the entire web. So why can't Google Chrome do an instantaneous search on one little HTML page that you have in memory? It should be at least as fast as doing a Google search in the first place. Google goes for their web response and search the entire web. It's supposed to be under a second, and usually it's a lot faster than that. How could it possibly take so long to search through some data? Well, Chromium is not actually indexing the data inside an HTML page. Why is DU taking so long? Why doesn't it remember how much space is used by all these files? Well, it's not remembering what's used by those files. Why not? I'll try to address that. And similarly for make, why is make having to look again and again through the file system to figure out what's changed? Why can't it just remember? Well, it can. This is not rocket science, but it's not actually done. So the simple story that I'd like to tell is why this sort of thing goes wrong, why these programs are so slow, even though everybody learns in data structures, algorithms, database operating systems classes, how to make these sorts of things go fast. I've distinguished here between different ways of storing data by the physical mechanism of storing data. When people are learning how to store data, then there's a separation between maybe algorithms, starting with programming and algorithms courses, where you learn how to organize data in memory. It's called the data structure, and then somehow the names change when you start storing things on disk, which is an important physical difference, but it's not something which fundamentally changes how data is laid out. You have persistent data structures, which are remembered after your program exits. You have databases, which are remembered after your program exits. You have file systems, which are remembered after your program exits. Depending what kind of course you have different names for the same kinds of structures for storing things on disk. And then there's distributed file systems, which raise many of the same concerns, and again have many different names, like the World Wide Web, network file systems, distributed file systems, some more than we're not thinking of right now. I'm not going to talk about distributed issues in this talk, but even between memory and disk, there's lots of different ways of organizing data that you see inside current computer systems. Now, when you take courses on these things, you of course see lots of problems like, okay, make a data structure which supports the following operations. Make a data structure which, for instance, remembers something about, you have a tree, say, and at each point in the tree, let's augment the tree so that at each node you remember how many nodes are below that, how much usage there is below that spot in the tree. And that's what DU is supposed to be computing, and it's doing it very, very slowly by looking through the whole tree under that node. Well, you can augment your data structure to make that very fast, so that looking at a node in the tree, you can very quickly keep track of a summary, just see that summary information about your data structure. Another common thing that you learn how to do with a data structure, especially with databases, is keeping change logs, keeping history. Structures like Git, where you keep track of what has changed inside your, database. And in the case of make, what make needs to know is exactly what has changed. Make has a long list of these dependencies and says, okay, I've got all these files I'm looking at, and if prog.c changes, then I need to then change all the following files. And make could be asking the file system, hey, can you please tell me if any of those things have changed? The file system, when prog.c changes, can record that in a structure that make efficiently looks at. And that's an example of keeping a log of changes. And it's something which you learn how to do with data structures and databases. But it's not something that make and the file system actually cooperate in. Another common thing you learn how to do is searching. indexing data in various ways so that various types of searches are fast. Again, all of these things are standard data structure exercises, but they're not actually done in these examples that I've given. So why are they not done? Well, let me look at a concrete example, a very simple program with a very simple data structure, and then see in this example the effect that I think is explaining why these programs are failing to actually make your computer run fast. How many people have seen data compression, like LZW, LZ77, see some show of hands, a few people. This again is something where I'm planning to introduce it from scratch. How many people have used data compression? Gzip, Bzip? Okay, at least some people are aware. LZSS is one of the compression mechanisms out there, which I like to explain in terms of decompression. So suppose you want to print the following string, yabba dabba dabba doo. You could print that string as follows. You start by printing the first characters literally, yabba doo. So now you're at this point in the string. And now you go back 5 characters from this point, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, so you're the A there, and then copy 4 characters. So you print ABBA again, you copy ABBA, which many musicians have done. And then, having gotten to this point, you now go back 5 characters and copy 5 characters. So now you copy ABBA, and now you're up to there, and then you print do. Now, this is LZSS decompression. It's taking a short input, at least conceptually short, and producing a longer output. I've expressed this here as, well, the information you need to get this process, this decompression process started, is you need to have this string and then the numbers, 5 and 4, and 5 and 5, and then do. Now, you have to be careful, of course, if your string can include numbers. You have to somehow be able to parse this, and maybe you need some extra bits to indicate which of these are numbers for copying and which of them are literal text to copy. But it's still going to be more concise than the original string. There's redundancy in the original string, which is getting exploited. And this, again, is LZSS decompression. If you want to compress a string, so if you're given this yabba dabba dabba doo, and you want to find this shorter string, which is a program to print the longer string, so that's the compression process, is finding that shorter string, then do something like this. You decide how big these numbers can be. For instance, you say, I'm willing to go back 4K, 4,096 bytes, and then from each position, I'm willing to copy at most 16 bytes. If you have more than that redundancy, then, hey, getting a factor of 16 compression is pretty good. Maybe you don't get a factor of 16, maybe you only get 8 or so, but that's still reasonable compression. You stop worrying at that point. So you set some limits like this, 4,096 and 16. And then you start looking from the front of your string. Okay, at what points do we actually have some repetitions? Like when you get to this, to the A here, then you see, aha, I've got a repetition, ABB, that matches, ABBA, that matches. Actually, could have gone even further, could have copied ABBAD, that would be the longest match, maybe. Maybe if you're careful about it, you could copy 6 characters from that point. So this is maybe not the optimal compression that I've done here, but what your compressor tries to do is figure out how many repetitions there are from each position. And then it prints out this string, which expresses the original string more concisely. What do you do to program this? Well, you might start saying, okay, I've got to store some data, the previous bytes and the 16 bytes that I'm compressing. And now the particular choices you make in engineering the software depend on the programming language that you're using. The program that you have is dependent heavily on your platform for doing the programming. Maybe you're writing this in C. And in C, the core data structure that you can use for everything is an array. So you might have a buffer, which has at most, at each moment you have to look back 4,096 bytes, look forward 16 bytes, you have a buffer of at most 4,096 plus 16 bytes that you care about, and then some variables to say how much of this buffer is actually initialized and how much is processed. So the buffer len would say at each moment how many bytes in this buffer are actually valid data that you've read in. And then the already encoded is saying how many of the bytes at the beginning of the buffer have you printed out in properly encoded form. At the beginning, your buffer len would be 0, and your already encoded would be 0, and then you read in data, you increase the buffer len to at most 4,096 plus 16, and then your already encoded is going to move along as you take out literal text or matches from the previous text. Okay, having decided on this data structure, you now say, I have to implement the compression, which you might not structure as these particular operations, but maybe you do say, okay, what does this object have to do for me? What operations does this data structure need to support? Well, first of all, you need to initialize it, say buffer len is zero, already encoded is zero, don't care about the contents of the buffer. You need to be able to read extra data in, which is putting data into the buffer and then increasing buffer len. More complicated, most complicated operation is finding the longest match. So you have a certain amount of data already encoded, and then from that point you've got some more data. You want to see how many of these forthcoming bytes, up to 16 bytes, match at any of the previous positions. So five positions back matches four, or whatever the matching is. So you have to search through all of the previous positions in the buffer, and at each position say how many of those bytes are matching. And then once you've found the longest match, then you print out something appropriate and then change this data structure again to move the already encoded up to the appropriate spot. And then if you're close to the end of the buffer, you have to shift everything over. So you have space for some new data in the buffer, copy everything over to the beginning of the buffer, move by, well, most 16 bytes is going to make enough space to keep going in the main loop. All of this is feasible. You can write this in about 30 lines of code. It's not hard to write an LZSS compressor. But then when you run that code, you're not happy with the speed. Just like you're not happy with the speed. I'm not happy with the speed of the browser or the file system. Well, you try running this code and you see it's painfully slow. Maybe you have some absolute idea of how fast compressors should be. Or maybe you say, okay, what does this really have to do? This seems like it should be faster. Or maybe you just talk to some users and say, okay, here's how long it would take you to compress a gigabyte of data using this program. And they say, oh, that's way too long. You need to give me something faster or else I won't use it. Why is this so slow? Well, the problem is the last operation here, moving past the map. So you've got some data that's already encoded, and then you say match 3 bytes or 4 bytes, and you've got the ABBA, and now you have to move along by 4 bytes, and assuming that you're in a sort of steady state of you've processed more than 4K, assuming your file's reasonably long, most of the time you're already encoded is going to be 4096, you've got 16 bytes past that, now you increase already encoded by, say, 4 bytes, ABBA. And now you have to copy everything back by 4 bytes to make room for up to 16 bytes past your already encoded spots. Your already encoded has to move from wherever it is bigger than 4096 back to 4096. And that copying takes some time. It's copying 4K of data. It's not super slow, but it's also not super fast if you have to do that for every byte or a few bytes of output. What would be a solution to this problem?
Circular queue.
Circular queue, yeah. So you've got either two buffers that you bounce between, or you've got a circular buffer or several buffers. So somehow you avoid copying the data. You just keep pointers to keep track of where you are, where your beginning and end are. So you don't insist on the beginning of the buffer being right at the beginning. You allow your beginning to move along, and then when you get sufficiently close to the end, then you can do a copy, but you only do that occasionally instead of doing it for every few bytes. There's a bigger problem here, which is this third operation, the finding the longest match. Now that's where you have, at a certain point, you've got ABBA or Boris. You've got some string, which now you're comparing to every single spot in the 4,096 previous spots. You have to do a string comparison of this Boris versus that doesn't match, versus BBA, oh, that matches one character, versus BBA, that matches one character. You do this comparison, and that takes at least 4,096 byte comparisons, and maybe more, depending on exactly how much of the match you have. Now, this problem you can address in various ways. For instance, you can put this data into an associative array. You can set up a quick index. There's all sorts of indexing structures which will keep track of what your longest matches are. The basic idea of these is you maintain for your 4,096 previous bytes, think of those as 4,096 strings starting at each previous position, and then you maintain those strings in somehow a sorted order. For instance, you have a tree of those 4096 or a hash table of those 4096 previous strings. You have to be a bit careful because you don't know the lengths of those strings that matter. There are several data structures that try to make this really, really fast. But any sort of indexing will do much better than having to search every possible position in the 4096 previous position. Okay, so you read through your code and say, ah, here's where the bottleneck is, and here's the kind of solution you want. Pick a solution, implement the solution. It's not too hard, but it did require taking all of the code that was manipulating this data structure and changing that code. So instead of initializing just the variables that were there before, you now have to initialize some more stuff for the circular buffer, and you have to initialize some index. And instead of moving along in the way that you moved along before, you now totally change how you access this array, even just for the circular buffer. When you add something to the array, you're changing how that code works for the circular buffer and for the index. It's not hard to do, but it means rewriting almost all of this code inside the compression program. You end up with, instead of your original 30-line program, you have maybe a 200-line program where you've rewritten all of the original stuff, maybe kept a few lines of input and output, but basically you've rewritten your entire compression program. Now, in the case of compression programs, people just do this. It's not that big a deal, and it gives you a huge speed up, no problem. But this particular software engineering cost of taking your data structures and changing your data structures because you want your operations to be faster, people sometimes say you want to support more operations. What they mean is, well, instead of looking through your whole data structure for a search, you want to make that kind of search fast. Or instead of looking through your whole data structure for a summary or change log, you change how your data is stored to make that fast. Instead of sticking to the original data structure that you decided on, the simplest one, you want to change this data structure, and that's something which happens all the time. As your programs, as your computer systems get larger and larger, you at some point have tens of millions of lines of code, you've got browsers, entire operating systems, and these things have this cost showing up again and again of people changing the data structures because the data structures are not satisfactory for providing the performance that you want for the operations that your programs are doing. Because you didn't plan ahead when you made your data structure for all of the operations that might have been applied to that data structure later. Chromium, obviously, is an example where you want to do exactly the same kind of indexing as in this data compression example. You just want to be able to search for a string, and Chromium isn't doing it.
Is that obvious? I thought it was an 8 megabyte file. Who cares about an index? Shouldn't it be done in milliseconds anyway?
Well, yeah. If you had a really fast search and you didn't have to deal with things like different encodings of text, and I don't know exactly what Chromium Search is trying to do, but if you just imagine, okay, it's trying to match uppercase and lowercase, then maybe your inner loop isn't going to be quite as fast as it should be. Admittedly, without looking at the code in Chromium, I can't guess how stupidly done it is, and I agree that just processing 8 megabytes and skipping past the pictures shouldn't be that much data, shouldn't be that much time. But what I do know is that Chromium is, as the web page gets bigger, scaling to get slower and slower and slower in what seems like a linear way. So it's doing some sort of linear search on whatever its data structure is. To give you a more reasonable answer, I would have to actually look at the Chrome code and tell you what it's doing for each byte that it's comparing to. But yeah, of course, string searching is something which shouldn't be at the absolute performance scale that you're seeing for 8 megabytes of data looking through. Shouldn't take 2.5 seconds, even on power save mode. But if you're designing something like a browser, then you're happy at the beginning writing code that just successfully displays a web page. And then you don't worry about the exact speed of something happening. You write simple code for expressing what the contents of the web page are, formatting it somehow for your screen. And then somebody says, hey, I want to search, and you implement the simplest search function you can think of, and it just works, and you're happy, and you don't worry about the speed. And it could be doing all sorts of stupid things. And then if you want to add, say, an index, which is the only way that you're going to get good performance as the web page gets bigger and bigger, get, you know, very much sub-second performance for, say, a gigabyte web page, you have to add an index, and Chromium doesn't do that. Obviously, Google does in the Google Web Search. Question?
I think another way to look at this might be to take a little bit of a step back and say, all right, I want to make the common case fast. And the common case is someone loads a web page, and they want that to load as quickly as like humanly possible or computationally possible. So that you, as the programmer, have one of two choices. You can either create that index at the same time, making every single load slower, or you can say, I'm just going to let it be a linear search. It'll be a little bit slow when a page is very, very big. But in the common case where no one does a search ever, or where the page is, you know, maybe 1 megabyte instead of 8, you're like, oh, well, the search will come back in a reasonable amount of time. I'm not going to worry about this adding overhead to my common case of loading a page without ever having to search it.
Absolutely, yeah. Most pages are small, first of all. This is the idea of the web page getting bigger and bigger. It's something that slowly happens over time, and it's something where 10 years ago, if you tell somebody, yeah, I've got an 8-megabyte web page, they look at you strangely like, possibly have an 8-megabyte web page. Don't be ridiculous. Web pages aren't that big. They're a few K. And yeah, you can say, yeah, let's do a simple linear search. And from a performance perspective, if you want to deal with the extreme cases of the web pages getting bigger and bigger, searching through more and more data, then I would agree that the first thing to do would be a linear search, and then falling back to, if you realize that the user is doing a few searches, making an index at that point. Unless your indexing is really, really fast, then you'll probably get better performance that way. But let me give another example, which is very analogous to this Chromium example. Do you use Gmail?
I do.
Why do you use Gmail?
Because I don't have to manage a SMTP server.
Okay. So that's the administrative issue, but you could, of course, use a university SMTP server, and you can use all sorts of packages which will maintain your mail on your computer, which should be faster, right?
That's true.
And somehow, okay, I don't use Gmail because of the issues of feeling like, yeah, I would rather have everything managed by me, everything on my computer. I'm not sure I want Google indexing everything, but my perception is that Gmail and similar services are taking over the email universe. And if I watch people using Gmail, then it seems to me that people very much appreciate how fast Gmail is at searching. Now, if you fire up a program like Pine or Mutt and ask it, please search through my mailbox, here's 10,000 messages, now which one contains the name of this conference, I'd like to have, please show me the 20 messages that have the name of this conference, then your typical client is doing some big search through all of your mail. Maybe it's adding some indexing feature to it, but I see people complaining all the time about this performance aspect of mail software. At the same time, I think when I see people saying, yeah, I still use Pine, for instance, I use Mutt, then one of the common reasons for that is that it starts up fast because you have everything on your computer. You type Mutt and you instantly have your mail sitting there. And if searches were faster, it would still feel like a benefit, but the searches are not faster. If you add some indexing to it, then you can make the searches faster, and that's what Gmail has done, but it was some software engineering effort for Gmail. It's something where lots of mail clients haven't done. So it's something where if you think, oh yeah, this web page, a browser shouldn't be thinking about web pages getting big, there's other applications where the amount of data you're dealing with is naturally much bigger than that, and still you can see the software engineering cost of adding index. And it's much more obvious that you have a performance problem for the typical case for people searching their email than you do for searching one web page.
Now, I think the meta question there is why. Obviously, people want this. Obviously, the performance is very, very slow in that case. And I guess the first thing I think of is like, well, it's obviously possible to do this. It's not like the people that maintain Mutt don't know how to implement a fast indexed search. But I don't know where you're going in the next couple of slides, but the first thing I think of is, you know, why not? And I'm sure you'll cover that soon.
Yeah, I see another question.
Is there a big memory hit for indexing, like web pages? Like, say you had 100 tabs open in Google Chrome. Is there going to like double the memory usage?
There can be, yeah. So I did peek at the memory usage for for Chromium for this, and it was something on the scale of a gigabyte, which is kind of surprising if you think 40 megabytes of data coming in. Why does it need a gigabyte to store that? I mean, it can't be compressing what it's doing, so it just starts with the original data, but for some reason it's expanding it, which maybe also is connected to why the searching is taking as long as 2 seconds. So there can certainly be a memory issue with building an index. There are efficient structures for things like if you just want to do simple searches on some data. You've got data this long, and you want to look for where is Boris in this string. Then that you can do with pretty small space overhead. But if you start doing fancier searches, approximate searches, I mean, all the things that Google does for its database centrally, then yeah, there is some space cost to that. And if you're putting that in RAM, then you can easily run out of memory. So maybe indexing isn't something that you want to be doing by default all the time. And that's the kind of performance trade-off where the most sophisticated data structure would say, I have an optional index. And I create it when it's giving me a performance advantage. And I leave it out when that's giving me the performance advantage by reducing memory. But most of the time, you get more performance advantage from reducing memory than from making computations faster. Okay. So why are people having to write all this code from scratch? Why do we have Chromium? The developers do a simple linear search instead of just using code. I mean, we've got 60 years of development of all these different data structures. Why isn't the software just out there? And, well, the software is just out there. Let's just pick associative arrays as the most important example of the data structure that you need, where you just want to say, I've got a string coming in and a string coming out. And now you have no constraints on what the strings are that you were looking up in this associative array. No constraints on what the strings are coming out of the associative array. You can implement this, for instance, as a hash table with the classic H search function in C, well, POSIX, Unix C. In C++, the standard template library now has an unordered map, which is a hash table. So this is an associative array. It's something where you can set up a map and say, inside my map, I would like to have hello mapping to your world. And then later on, you come back and say, what is hello map to? And it tells you world. And that's very efficient. So these are both storing hash tables in memory. And then lots of different packages for doing the same thing, storing hash tables on disk. And at some point, DB came along and said it's silly to have a difference between how you store things in memory and how you store things on disk. Let's have one package, DB, which can store things on memory or transparently on disk. If you want persistence for the data, it backs it up on disk. If you want to have it just in memory, then you keep it in memory, but you don't have to change how you're accessing it. You just use the DB package for everything. Another example of an associative array, Unix file names inside a directory. Depending on your file system, if you have X3 with the directory index feature or SGI's file systems, Riser FS, I guess, X4, I think, has it turned on by default. Any file system that has directory indexing is somehow storing an associative array of here's the names in your directory, and those are in some sort of hash table or maybe tree, which is allowing you to do fast lookups of a new name. Instead of just having, if you have a million files in a directory on a classic Unix file system, it's very, very slow to look through that list. If you have, or to add something, remove something from that list. If you have a hash table for the names, which some Unix file systems give you, then that'll be much, much faster for adding and removing files or searching for files. Another example of an associative array, the classic awk language, or modern example, Python. If you have an associative array in Python, a dictionary, then you can just say x bracket hello equals, well, got this on the next slide. You say x bracket hello equals 5 if you start with x is a dict, and then later on you can look up x bracket hello and it gives you back this 5. Or another example, perfectly analogous, slight differences in syntax in the shell. So this is again the associative array for files in a directory under Unix. In the shell, if you say put 5 into a hello file in the X directory, then that's again an associative array. And later on, you can come back and ask for the hello file in the X directory and get the contents of it, which are a 5. Both of these syntaxes are very, very simple. Simple enough that when people use these languages, they gravitate towards using this very convenient feature by default. Just like in C, people gravitate towards using simple arrays because that's the easiest thing to do. Which works great if what you need is exactly an associative array. However, sometimes you need more than that. And this is where the trouble starts. You've got the language is giving you some basic data structure, and then you realize that what your program needs is some more operations on this data structure. For instance, maybe you're maintaining an event queue, a priority queue. So this is the classic priority queue is, for instance, you're keeping track of things that you have to do. You have a to-do list. And each item on the to-do list says this must be done at this moment. Maybe it says it must be done by this moment and it's going to take this long. And maybe you have to maintain charts and get charts and such. But a classic priority queue says when the time gets to this, you have to do this event. You also have to be able to put on new events into this list. So your basic operations on a priority queue, for instance, a heap, are you find the first event, the thing you have to do next. If that's now, you do it. If it's later, you wait. And then remove that from your list. And then you put new events on the list in whatever order. So those are the priority queue operations. And those are not supported by, if you in Python have a dictionary, it's a hash table, which does not efficiently support finding the first event. If you try to say, OK, give me the smallest key in a hash table, smallest key in a dictionary, you can do it. It's a short piece of code, but it's very, very slow as the hash table gets big, as the dictionary gets big. Something similar is true for files in a directory, that if you have inside the X directory, if you have more and more files in that directory, and then you say, please give me the first file, that's a very slow operation. You end up having to look through all of the names inside that directory. And this causes all sorts of performance problems that motivate people to change how they're storing data. In Python, the officially approved way to support priority queues is to use a heap queue. It's part of the Python standard library, and it supports exactly the priority queue operations, finding the first event, removing the first event, putting a new event on at whatever spot. It does have a bracket operation, but it's not the same as this one. You don't get to look up a name in your heap. A name in your priority queue, you can say bracket 0, which is going to be the first entry in your heap, but you don't get to say something like bracket hello. If you try to use a dictionary as a heap or vice versa, you can't. The operations are just almost completely incompatible. You don't get the same dictionary bracket as if you're using a heap. You don't get the priority queue, heap push, and heap pop if you're using a dictionary. You can take a dictionary in one line of code, turn it into a heap, or take a heap and in one line of code, convert it to a dictionary, but that's slow. And the whole point of all these fancy data structures is to speed up the computer, and that's what's going wrong. So you don't want to do this kind of conversion. So what happens if you've got some Python library which is giving you a dict back, and then you want to know the first element in that dict? It's slow. Even though there is a heap queue, you're not using the heap queue. Now, how should we fix this? Well, the standard data structure textbook answer is, okay, make an appropriate data structure which supports all the operations you need. For instance, red-black trees, B-trees, ABL trees. These are structures which support finding the first element efficiently, and they support associative array, put in an element at a particular index, remove an element at a particular index where the index can be any string you want, find the first, find the last index, find and everything between some range of indices. If you have an ABL tree, that's easy to do. Typical tree structures support all these operations. So how do you use this in Python? Maybe there's some ABL tree. I think actually the one in the PyPy library, it's ABL underscore tree. You get back an empty tree structure, and then you call some library, some MyStuff library, which then adds things to this ABL tree. And then, because ABL tree supports a first operation, you can get the first element of this ABL tree. So you can do the basic priority operation along with the associative array operations. Inside this library, which might be tons of code, the library can do things that don't know whether it's a dict or an ABL tree or any other structure that supports associative array operations. It can just say d bracket hello equals 5, and it can do d bracket whatever it wants, as if you were a dict. Because Python supports what's called duck typing, it's an abstract classing mechanism for these different data structures where you don't even have to say, I've got a data structure that supports these different kinds of operations. You just go ahead and try this operation, and it works. Duck typing, the name is for, if it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it's a duck. That's why Python and Smalltalk and such, it's called duck typing. I think the name is a lot newer than the language is, but you just try doing an operation inside this library, and it works with a dict. It works with an ABL tree, and then the programmer calling this library can then give it an ABL tree, which supports extra operations beyond what this library was imagining that you'd want to do with the structure. However, Python does not encourage you to do this. In Python, it's just as easy, maybe even a little bit easier, for a library to create its own dictionaries and not have you give it an object to add stuff to. So you have your MyStuff library maintaining its own dictionary, maybe returning the dictionary to you. If you want to change that dictionary to an ABL tree, maybe it's just changing one or two lines of code inside the MyStuff function, but you still have to change that library. And that's a software engineering cost, which even though you're reusing ABL tree code that's sitting there, you still have to change components of your system. You still incur the software engineering cost of having a decision about your data structures being modified, being changed, which means taking every library that knows about that decision, every module that knows about that decision, and doing something with it. Maybe not very much, but it's a huge cost in the end when your systems get bigger and bigger. And this, I think, is exactly why systems like Mutt, Chromium, and so on don't have citizens, even though the libraries are just sitting there. Because they start with, they have a simpler data structure, and there's enough parts of the code that know about that data structure that just making this one little tweak, please use an ABL tree instead of whatever else it's doing, seems like it should just be a tiny change, but it's probably changing tens of thousands of lines of code, because there's all sorts of scattered parts of the system that know about the decision to use a hash table and not use an ABL tree. Some of this problem is dealt with by the Unix file system. This will be the last section of my talk, which gives you by default all of the operations that I've talked about. First of all, the file system is a tree. So if you want tree operations, then the file system naturally maps your operations to easy to understand objects in the file system. You've got a top root directory and then subdirectories of that, and then sub-subdirectories and so on. Each of the nodes in this tree, each of the directories in this tree, is indexed by strings. So you've got inside your slash, etc., for example, you've got a whole bunch of files in that directory, and each of those files is named by a string. Each of the subdirectories is named by a string. You can look those sub-nodes, those files and subdirectories up by the names, so you have a function mapping your string and your current node to a subnode of that. And then at the leaves of the file system, you have another array structure, which is just a simple array of bytes. So you've got each file is indexed by 0 through whatever the size of the file is, and then at each position in the file, you've got a byte. So each byte in the file system is indexed by, let's see, a sequence of strings, which are telling you the slash etc., slash this, slash that. That sequence of strings and then a byte number, those pinpoint a byte stored in a file, somewhere in the file system. There's all sorts of implementations of exactly the same interface, exactly the same concept, is actually stored in many different ways, which you don't normally think about. So the X3 file system or the Berkeley Fast file system, these provide the same interface with maybe differences in details, which most applications never see. You don't have to talk to a typical application if you're going to change the implementation of your file system. You just provide the same interface. It's a reasonably narrow interface, which allows you the flexibility to change the implementation, change your data structure. Now, as I said, the basic good thing about this data structure stored on disk is that it has this tree feature. It has the ability to do, for instance, looking up all of the strings, looking up all of the indices that start with A/B. If you think for a moment, how do I do that with a Python dictionary? It's something you have to do all the time. Find all of the indices, find all of the keys in a data structure which start with a certain prefix. This is one of the most common operations in programming. The file system makes it trivial. You give the prefix with some slashes, and then you just look inside that directory. Your cost is going to be just however many nodes you have starting with that prefix. If you try to do it with a hash table, it's very, very expensive as the hash table gets big. If you, again, make something like dict, it just doesn't support this operation efficiently. So people don't even think about using dict for storing structures where you need to do this all the time. What's bad about this three-level structure is that, well, there are all these ad hoc separations between, you've got the tree, you've got at each node in the tree, you've got an associative array. At the leaf nodes, you've got another level of array. And these three different data structures are handled by three different kinds of functions and don't talk to each other at all, with somewhat different performance features, somewhat different historical expectations, even though conceptually they're all doing the same thing. You've got a tree, you've got a list of strings indexing a byte, where the last string is a byte number. The previous ones are strings of whatever length. And that tree structure, each level there is handled in different ways. The byte index is handled completely differently from the strings used higher up. And this means that applications deciding what to do end up making all sorts of different decisions of where to put their string structure within the multiple levels here. So you have some applications that say, oh yeah, I'm going to have a directory of files. And other applications that say, no, I'm going to have inside my file, I'm going to have inside this array, I'm going to have my own structure for storing things. How do you make that decision? There's no default obvious decision because there's a separation between different ways of storing things. Suppose that you want to add some features to the file system, like du. You want to make du fast. You can do that. You can change what X3 does, add a feature to X3, go ahead, change the X3 code, and your application is not going to be bothered by it. Because even if you had to rename it, you'd no longer have X3. You've got X3 du to make du fast. Your application has never said X3. It's just going to work with X3 du. You just, as the administrator, plug in an X3 du instead of an X3. So changing the file system is not something that typical applications are going to do. However, there is no default way for an application to access these new features. If you want to say, I would like to implement du efficiently using this file system feature, there's no canonical way in Unix to say, structure, give me an extra operation. Also, if you've got a change to the file system, I said, well, you just add this feature to X3. But if you actually want a user to use that, then you have to take X3 and not just change the code, tweak the code for this data structure and ship it with your program. You have to go through the administrator of the system, probably go through some, say, Ubuntu or Debian, go through some distributor who will ship your extra file system features with their file system. It's something integrated into the kernel in a way that makes it not easy to change. Again, this du example, it's obvious what to do to make du run fast. And it's something where people are doing it all the time. And if it were easy to make it run fast, then it would have been done already. It wouldn't be a continuing problem. There are systems where du is very, very fast. But Unix is not one of those systems. Du minus s, you could just imagine that as soon as it's been computed, you store the result, and then if some file changes, it updates or invalidates the results above it. It's obvious how to make du run fast. But suppose that you actually put this into your file system. What is your application supposed to do to read the du result? Maybe some systems will tell you you should have a new I/O control to get this extra information. Maybe you should do more invasive kernel changes to change what the on-disk structure is that you get back from stat and fstat. Maybe you should have a file name that you access, things like resource forks on some operating systems, where you've got a name that you allocate within the directory where if you read that name, it tells you how much space is used, what the output of du minus s would be on that directory. None of these are canonical choices, and all of them have hassles for trying to implement them. If you compare this to what you have to do for, say, Python to add a new function like first or total usage, something to a data structure, you just define that function in your data structure. The caller calls that function. It's in a namespace which is not the same as the namespace for storing the indices in your files. It's storing the indices of your data. It's something where you might still worry about conflicts in this namespace, but realistically, there's much less of a problem here with adding new functions to Python data structures than there is with adding new operations to the file system. Even if you get past this and you say, okay, here's the right way to modify the file system, here's the right way for applications to use it, then you end up with this deployment hassle where X3 is inside the kernel. How do you change something that's inside the kernel? It's not nearly as convenient as changing something at the application layer. There's a whole process around this where the kernel's not really designed to play well with people. It's something where developers working on the kernel have to go through much more hassle than developers working on applications. There's all sorts of ways to try to delegate work from the kernel to applications. I think the first one that I played with once upon a time was loopback NFS, which I think is still supported on Unix these days, but got all sorts of problems with it. Fuse is the new version of that. The Plan 9 operating system has a cleaner mechanism for doing this. But realistically, if you want to write an application that uses these features, it's much, much more of a hassle than making a new data structure in a reasonable language. Okay. Here's my last slide. There's a wonderful paper from about 40 years ago, exactly 40 years ago, by Parnas, who introduced the concept of information hiding into software engineering. His paper title was On the Criteria to be Used in Decomposing Systems into Modules. And he went through some examples of, here's a typical way to take a system and decide what the modules are. It's the main operations in the system. Let's make each operation a module. And then he contrasted that to a different strategy, which is summarized here. You make a list of design decisions that are likely to change. Design decisions that you're not sure about for your program. For instance, data structure design decisions, which are actually most of his examples. And then you put those decisions into one module in your system. You rigorously hide that information from everything else. You make sure that the rest of your system does not know what that data structure is. Because if you want to change that decision, it's going to be much, much easier to just change one module than to change your entire system. What's happening right now is that we've got, unfortunately, data structure knowledge. Knowledge about associative arrays, Dick's saying Python. Knowledge about DB in the C language. Knowledge about the Unix file system operations. These are embedded into a huge number of applications. If you want to change how those work, you have to change a huge number of modules. Just that software engineering cost is, I believe, what's accounting for Chromium and lots of other programs being so slow. Thanks for your attention.
Thank you. I'd like to ask a kind of general question, specific to what you talked about, but you have a lot of experience writing mathematical programs, and you know, yourself. So I want to talk to you to talk about your workflow. Are you good enough where you can just guide him on
that? Mike, would you speak up?
Yes. I'm asking if he's a good enough programmer that he designs things and it runs best from the beginning, does he inspect his code manually and identify bottlenecks? Or are there some tools that you'd like to share with us that you'd like to use to find bottlenecks?
Yeah, so I guess for optimization, the easiest tool is a CPU cycle counter. Assuming your slugging has a conveniently accessible cycle counter. When you get to bigger system level stuff, you actually can get quite a bit of information still out of the cycle counter, so there's still quite a bit of hassle. But as a performance tool, it's very precise, and then it has well understood inaccuracies. And then if you're willing to deal with it, maintain cycle counter information, then it's a way to get very fine grained information about where your system is using this. But yeah, in general, you have to expect that you're going to have bottlenecks
Did you say just an example saying solve? See something, sort of talk to how easier or not.
Let's get rolling for pizza.
I mean, yeah, if people want to leave,
yeah, pizza. Well, pizza, if you want to.
Pizza, if you want to. Pizza, if you want to.
In general, so I should say, I've got this code, first of all, if you don't notice the performance of it, if you don't have some application where you can see the performance of it, it's a problem, then don't worry about it. And then if you do have a performance problem, then you have to identify which part of the code is producing that performance problem. And then, in the case of a cryptographic library like Salt, it's reasonably clear where the bottlenecks are. But then you have to say, okay, how do you fix those bottlenecks? And that's where you have to have a good idea of the performance that you're aiming for. So micro-optimization, I would say, is a different game from, if you have something like data structure optimization, then it's much more about scalability and saying, okay, I've got some algorithm which is poorly chosen, and it's going to be much, much faster if I just change it like this. And there's so many of those bad decisions. Just say, oh, here's where the bottlenecks are, and just fix the data structures in those bad spots. Then you'll make everything much, much faster, and then some other part of your system will be the bottleneck, some other part that somebody else has to worry about. When you get down to micro-optimization of something that's computationally intensive, then the game changes, and there you really have to think, okay, what computations do I have to do, and how long should those take? And there you really need to understand how the CPU works, and what the lower bound is for the amount of time, and then compare how much time you're actually spending to that lower bound. And if there's a gap, understand the gap, explain the gap. It's something which is much more platform specific than, say, data structure decisions, where there's some physical interaction. But
yeah, some people are very good at that, establishing the lower bound.
On L4? Yeah. I've read some L4 advertising, but not the original papers.
He did what you're describing. He reasoned through a very strong lower bound and attempted it.
I have a question on the talk cloud. What does that do you with this?
What was the question?
So you have the conclusion, you need modularization. How does this work in the case of DU?
Well, you have to be able to change the file system in order to add an extra feature, namely this summary information, in a way that the file system supporting the summary information can easily say, oh yeah, here's the right way to make it available to applications. And applications can easily say, oh yeah, here's the right way to get that information out of the file system. So there needs to be some sufficiently canonical or standardized way to have these different, well, the implementation of the file system and the wizard of the file system talk to each other, that they know what to do, and then go ahead and implement it. So DU would, for compatibility with older file systems, probably continue to do what it does now, but first say, does the file system I'm talking to support this total usage feature? And if so, then it just reports the result of that very fast. And then the file system simply has to implement that. It's right now just a deployment hassle to make that work. If you want to modify X3, it's much more annoying for, I mean, the person who's writing DU can't just say, oh, I'm also going to change the file system. If they do, then they're facing a whole path through getting it into the kernel, which right now is much, much more of a hassle than changing DU itself.
But they have to change the interface, and that means that they do change the kernel. The kernel has to support that interface in some way.
So the Unix kernel structuring says that if you want to talk to the file system, then there's nothing particularly obviously extensible in that, except for, well, the file name structure. I mean, this is the most obvious way to talk. So IO controls are also extensible, but it's a much more compressed mechanism where you know you're going to bump into somebody else if you make a new IO control. Special file names, you can hope that if you just say inside a directory, you're going to have a file called dot, this is the DU user, that maybe that won't crash into anybody else doing it. And then you don't need an explicit change to the API. It's something where you should settle on what the name is, you should avoid conflict somehow, which is where this gets tricky, but it's unfortunately not in a separated namespace. The features that you want to add to the file system versus the names of files that the user wants to store, but you can hope that this is going to work. And then your file system can implement that and you can look for that. But I'm not saying this is a good solution. If you compare it to what happens in Python, where there's a clear namespace to use for new operations to support for a data structure, and then, okay, you don't have to be worried about that crashing into the data that's stored inside the, like a dict, if you added to a dict a total usage function, then you wouldn't have to worry that a user's
adding some information to the dictionary, which is called total usage, and crashing into the function. So that initial separation is already quite helpful in making sure you don't have conflicts. And in the case of a file system, you don't have that obvious separation. I'm not saying that's the end of the story. You still have to worry about these functions crashing into each other, which is the main objection to duck typing, is that it's not explicit enough, not enough of a hassle for people to add new functions so that you can accidentally call somebody else's function that has the same name. But realistically, this works in a way that this doesn't. I saw a hand in the back. But I guess not anymore.
I'm curious, is the conversational threading part of the indexing?
Sorry, bring that back.
Is conversational threading part of the indexing?
Well, threading is certainly something where, yeah, conceptually threading is, you say for each message what the previous message is, possibly what the next messages are going to be. And that's something which you can say should be part of the data structure. You've got your list of mail messages, which is a data structure, which should perhaps have these pointers backward and forward, saying how your threads are structured. So adding in that tree to a data structure is obvious how you store that inside the computer. But then, as a software engineering matter, how do you actually put that into your mail clients in a way that it has to be a persistent data structure, which hopefully many mail clients support, but even ignoring that, just having one mail client do it, you have to change quite a bit of code for how that mail client puts in a new message in order to support this new data structure. Even though this problem has been solved 1,000 times before, it's not solved in a way that's realistically reusable inside the mail client.
So if we've known this for 40 years, then why isn't anybody using it right now? Is it just extremely hard to think that way when you start building your system? Is it hard to say, oh, well, you know, I have to, yeah.
Well, this is after the Unix design was pretty much understood.
But so for the Chromium instance, or for the Mutton system, I say, okay, well, there's this idea from, I guess for Chromium it would be like 35 years ago, that says maybe we should compose things in a more elegant way. Are they building on so much legacy code that it would be infeasible for them to start from a different starting point where they say, okay, we are going to hide difficult design decisions behind layers of abstraction?
I think that can be one of the answers. In the case of Chromium, my assumption looking at any big monolithic program, even if the designers say, oh, we've got this wonderful internal structure to it, my assumption is that people doing big programs are not paying attention to what else is out there. Because if they were, they would have a more finely separated program. A typical browser is a new operating system. And within that operating system, people are re-implementing all sorts of standard ideas for how an operating system should work with more or less success. I hate it when inside the browser operating system I'm typing something and it's not responding because it's busy doing something else, because they're around the 20-year-old Mac OS level of concurrency handling. But okay, they're building a new operating system, slowly re-understanding what an operating system has to do. It's not integrated with your surrounding operating system, like Linux or Windows. And my perhaps somewhat obnoxious but default presumption in this case is that, yeah, these people aren't really trying to use what's out there. So of course they're not going to reuse the file system, they're not going to reuse the structures that are there. Having said that, yeah, there are convenient libraries which people do sometimes use, and so you can look inside a browser and see they are using Zlib. They are using all sorts of libraries that are there that they wouldn't want to re-implement. And it's interesting to see which of those things feel like there's so much pain for the implementer to re-implement that they are happy to take what's out there versus the ones where they do it themselves, because that's how most of these big programs go. I think there's some of people not paying attention to well-understood principles, but like this, there's some amount of people just have to get code written. I want to do a new browser. It has to be done this year. And I've got my idea of how to write it. And then until you redesign it from scratch, you don't realize how it should be done.
So the counterpoint to this is that it's simply easier to couple different levels of code that will make it, you know, it'll run fast in this case that we expect, but in the future when we want to change a couple of the assumptions behind how our system works, then everything goes to heck in a handbasket.
Yeah, you certainly, when you're So this principle in general, when you're violating the principle, it tends to be because you want to do something now and you're not thinking through all the ways you're going to want to change things later, which you often can't predict everything. Something like a data structure being something that you're going to want to change. I think that's something where the general concept has been out there for many years, but people seeing, oh yeah, I am doing a data structure here, I am going to want to change this, it's something which takes some effort to internalize. And then there are much more subtle design decisions which you just have no chance of realizing when you're building the original system that you're going to want to change those. In the case of things like data structures, databases, file systems, I think it's so clear that things are going wrong and that things have to be done better. I mean, the users really are suffering from how slow the computer is for these applications. Maybe not for Chromium, maybe people don't always have 8 megabyte web pages, but there's lots of examples where the computer is just taking a long time because it's not doing efficient indexing, not doing efficient summaries or logs of what's happened. And clearly the technology is there to make these things work better, but it's too much of a hassle to get these things in place. That's why my title was Data Structure Lock-In, that right now we have these data structures that we know are not the data structures that we want, but it's too much of a software engineering challenge to change those to better data structures.
Seminar tech, where there's a full list of our talks.